grabbed the credentials out of his hand. He opened them and checked the name. Clifford Maxwell. Bosch turned him around and shoved the creds into the side pocket of his jacket. "Your career is over," Maxwell said calmly. "Tell me about it," Bosch said. Maxwell looked at Ferris. "You go along with this and you're in the toilet too," he said. "You better think about it."
"Shut up, Cliff," Bosch said.
"The only one who is going to be in the toilet is you when you get back to tactical and tell them how you let two of the local yokels get the drop on you." That shut him up. Bosch opened the front door and walked the agent in. He roughly pushed him down into a stuffed chair in the living room. "Have a seat," he said, "and shut the fuck up." He reached down and opened up Maxwell's jacket so he could see where he carried his weapon. His gun was in a pancake holster under his left arm. He would not be able to reach it with his wrists cuffed behind his back. Bosch frisked the agent's lower legs to make sure he wasn't carrying a throwdown. Satisfied, he stepped back. "Relax now," he said. "We won't be long." Bosch started down the hallway, signaling his partner to follow him. "You start in the office and I'll start in the bedroom," he instructed. "We're looking for anything and everything. We'll know it when we see it. Check the computer. Anything unusual, I want to know about it." "Harry." Bosch stopped in the hallway and looked at Ferris. He could tell that his young partner was running scared. He let him have his say, even though they were still within earshot of Maxwell. "We shouldn't be doing it this way," Ferris said. "How should we be doing it, Ignacio? You mean we should be going through channels? Have our boss talk to his boss? Grab a latte and wait for permission to do our job?" Ferris pointed down the hallway toward the living room. "I understand the need for speed," he said. "But do you think he's going to let this go? He's going to have our badges, Harry. And I don't mind going down in the line of duty, but not for what we just did." Bosch admired Ferris for saying "we," and that gave him the patience to calmly step back and put a hand on his partner's shoulder. He lowered his voice so Maxwell would not hear him from the living room. "Listen to me, Ignacio. Not one thing is going to happen to you because of this. Not one thing, okay? I've been around a little longer than you, and I know how the Bureau works. Hell, my ex-wife is ex-Bureau, okay? And the one thing I know better than anything is that the number one FBI priority is not to be embarrassed. That is a philosophy they teach them at Quantico, and it seeps into the bones of every agent in every field office in every city. Do not embarrass the Bureau. So when we are done here, and we cut that guy loose, he's not going to tell a single soul what we did or that we were even here. Why do you think they had him sitting on the house? Because he's F.B. Einstein? Uh-uh. He's working off an embarrassment, either to himself or the Bureau, and he's not going to do or say a thing that brings him any more heat." Bosch paused to allow Ferris to respond. He didn't. "So let's just move quickly here and check out the house," Bosch continued. "When I was here this morning, it was all about the widow and dealing with her, and then we had to run out the door to St. Aggie's. I want to take my time, but be quick. You know what I mean? I want to see the place in daylight and grind the case down for a while. This is how I like to work. You'd be surprised what you come up with sometimes. The thing to remember is that there's always a transfer. Those two killers left their mark somewhere in this house, and I think SID and everybody else missed it. There's got to be a transfer. Let's go find it." Ferris nodded. "Okay, Harry." Bosch clapped him on the shoulder. "Good. I'll start in the bedroom. You check the office." Bosch moved down the hallway and was to the threshold of the bedroom when Ferris called his name again. Bosch turned and went back down the hallway to the office alcove. His partner was standing behind the desk. "Where's the computer?" Ferris asked. Bosch shook his head in frustration. "It was on the desk. They took it."
"The FBI?"
"Who else?" "It wasn't on the SID log, only the mouse pad." "Just look around, go through the desk, see what else you can find. We're not taking anything, we're just looking.
Bosch went down the hall to the master bedroom. It appeared to be undisturbed since he had last seen it. There was still a slight odor of urine due to the soiled mattress. He walked over to the night table on the left side of the bed. He saw black fingerprint powder dusted across the knobs on the two drawers and its flat surfaces. On top of the table were a lamp and a framed photograph of Stanley and Alicia Kent. Bosch picked up the photo and studied it. The couple was standing next to a rose bush in full bloom. Alicia had dirt smudged on her face, but was smiling broadly, as if she were standing proudly next to her own child. Bosch could tell that the rose bush was hers, and in the background he could see others just like it. Farther up the hillside were the first three letters of the Hollywood sign, and he realized the photo was probably taken in the backyard of the house. There would be no more pictures of the happy couple like this. Bosch put the photo down and slid open the table's drawers, one by one. They were full of personal items belonging to Stanley, various reading glasses, books, and prescription bottles. The lower drawer was empty, and Bosch remembered that it was the place where Stanley had kept his gun. Bosch closed the drawers and stepped into the corner of the room on the other side of the table. He was looking for a new angle, some sort of fresh take on the crime scene. He realized that he needed the crime scene photos, and he had left them in a file in the car. He walked down the hallway toward the front door. When he got to the living room, he saw Maxwell lying on the floor in front of the chair he had been placed in. He had managed to move his handcuffed wrists down over his hips. His knees were bent up with his wrists cuffed behind them. He looked up at Bosch with a red and sweating face.
"I'm stuck," Maxwell said. "Help me out."
Bosch almost laughed.
"In a minute."
He walked out the front door and went to the car, where he retrieved the files containing the SID crime scene reports and photos. He had put the copy of the emailed photo of Alicia Kent in there as well. As he walked back into the house and headed toward the hallway to the rear rooms, Maxwell called out to him,
"Come on, help me out, man."
Bosch ignored him. He walked down the hallway and glanced into the home office as he passed. Ferras was going through the drawers of the desk, stacking things he wanted to look at on top of it. In the bedroom, Bosch got the email photo out and put the files down on the bed. He held the photo up so he could compare it to the room. He then went to the mirrored closet door and opened it at an angle that matched the photograph. He then noticed in the photo the white terry cloth robe draped over a lounge chair in the corner of the room. He stepped into the closet and looked for the robe, found it, and put it in the same position on the lounge chair. Bosch moved to the place in the room from which he believed the email photo had been taken. He scanned the room, hoping something would poke through and speak to him. He noticed the dead clock on the bed table and then checked it against the email photo. The clock was dead in the photo, too. Bosch walked over to the table, crouched, and looked behind it. The clock was unplugged. He reached behind the table and plugged it back in. The digital screen started flashing 12 o'clock in red numerals. The clock worked. It just needed to be set. Bosch thought about this and knew it would be something to ask Alicia Kent about. He assumed the men who were in the house had unplugged the clock. The question was why. Perhaps they didn't want Alicia Kent to know how much or how little time had gone by while she waited tied up on the bed. Bosch put the clock issue aside and moved to the bed, where he opened one of the files and took out the crime scene photographs. He studied these and noticed that the closet door was open at a slightly different angle from the one in the email photo, and that the robe was gone, obviously because Alicia Kent had put it on after her rescue. He stepped over to the closet, matched the door's angle to the one in the crime scene photograph, and then stepped back to the door and scanned the room. Nothing broke through. The transfer still eluded him. He felt discomfort in his gut. He felt as though he was missing something, something that was right there in the room with him. Failure brings pressure. Bosch checked his watch and saw that the federal meeting, if there was actually going to be one, was to begin in less than 3 hours. He left the bedroom and made his way down the hall toward the kitchen, stopping in each room and checking closets and drawers, and finding nothing suspicious or amiss. In the workout room, he opened a closet door and found it lined with musty cold-weather clothes on hangers. The Kents had obviously migrated to L.A. from colder climes, and like most people who came from somewhere else, they refused to part with their winter gear. Nobody ever knew for sure how much of L.A. they could take. It was always good to be ready to run. He left the contents of the closet untouched and closed the door. Before leaving the room, he noticed a rectangular discoloration on the wall next to the hooks where rubber workout mats hung. There were slight tape marks indicating that a poster or maybe a large calendar had been taped to the wall. When he got to the living room, Maxwell was still on the floor, red-faced and sweating from struggling. He now had one leg through the loop created by his cuffed wrists, but he apparently couldn't get the other through in order to bring his hands to the front of his body. He was lying on the tiled floor with his wrists bound between his legs. He reminded Bosch of a 5-year-old holding himself in an effort to maintain bladder control. "We're almost out of here, Agent Maxwell," Bosch said. Maxwell didn't respond. In the kitchen, Bosch went to the back door and stepped out onto a rear patio and garden. Seeing the yard in daylight changed his perspective. It was on an incline, and he counted 4 rows of rose bushes going up the embankment. Some were in bloom and some weren't. Some relied on support sticks that carried markers identifying the different kinds of roses. He stepped up the hillside and studied a few of these, then returned to the house. After locking the door behind him, he walked across the kitchen and opened another door, which he knew led to the adjoining 2-car garage. A bank of cabinets stretched along the back wall of the garage. One by one, he opened them and surveyed the contents. There were mostly tools for gardening and household chores, and several bags of fertilizer and soil nutrients for growing roses. There was a wheeled trash can in the garage. Bosch opened it and saw one plastic trash bag in it. He pulled it out, loosened the pull strap, and discovered it contained what appeared to be only basic kitchen trash. On top was a cluster of paper towels that were stained purple. It looked like someone had cleaned up a spill. He held one of the towels up and smelled grape juice on it. After returning the trash to the container, Bosch left the garage and ran into his partner in the kitchen. "He's trying to get loose," Ferras said of Maxwell. "Let him try. Are you finished in the office?" "Just about. I was wondering where you were." "Go finish up and we'll be out of here." After Ferras was gone, Bosch checked the kitchen cabinets and the walk-in pantry and studied all the groceries and supplies stacked on the shelves. After that, he went to the guest bathroom in the hall and looked at the spot where the cigarette ash had been collected. On the white porcelain tank top, there was a brown discoloration about half the length of a cigarette. Bosch stared at the mark, curious. It had been 7 years since he had smoked, but he didn't remember ever leaving a cigarette to burn like that. If he had finished it, he would have thrown it into the toilet and flushed it away. It was clear that this cigarette had been forgotten. With his search complete, he stepped back into the living room and called to his partner. "Ignacio, you ready? We're leaving." Maxwell was still on the floor, but looked tired from his struggle and resigned to his predicament.
"Come on, damn it," he finally cried out. "Uncuff me."
Bosch stepped close to him. "Where's your key?" he asked.
"Coat pocket, left side."
Bosch bent over and worked his hand into the agent's coat pocket. He pulled out a set of keys and fingered through them until he found the cuff key. He grabbed the chain between the 2 cuffs and pulled up so he could work the key in. He wasn't gentle about it. "Now be nice if I do this," he said.
"Nice? I'm going to kick your fucking ass."
Bosch let go of the chain, and Maxwell's wrists dropped to the floor.
"What are you doing?" Maxwell yelled. "Undo me!"
"Here's a tip, Cliff. Next time you threaten to kick my ass, you might want to wait until after I've cut you loose."
Bosch straightened up and tossed the keys onto the floor on the other side of the room.
"Uncuff yourself."
Bosch headed to the front door. Ferras was already going through it. As Bosch was pulling it closed, he looked back at Maxwell sprawled on the floor. The agent's face was as red as a stop sign as he sputtered one last threat in Bosch's direction.
"This isn't over, asshole."
"Got it."
Bosch closed the door. When he got to the car, he looked over the roof at his partner. Ferras looked as mortified as some of the suspects who had ridden in the back seat.
"Cheer up," Bosch said.
As he got in, he had a vision of the FBI agent crawling in his nice suit across the living room floor to the keys. Bosch smiled. Chapter 12. On the way back down the hill to the freeway, Ferras was silent, and Bosch knew he had to be thinking about the jeopardy his young and promising career had been placed in because of his old and reckless partner's actions. Bosch tried to draw him out of it.
"Well, that was a bust," he said. "I got nada. You find anything in the office?"
"Nothing much. I showed you. The computer was gone."
There was a sullen tone in his voice.
"What about the desk?" Bosch asked.
"It was mostly empty. One drawer had tax returns and stuff like that. Another had a copy of a trust. Their house and investment property in Laguna, insurance policies, everything like that is held in a trust. Their passports were in the desk, too."
"Got it. How much did the guy make last year?"
$250,000 take-home. He also owns 51% of the company."
"The wife make anything?"
"No income. Doesn't work."
Bosch grew quiet as he contemplated things. When they got down off the mountain, he decided not to get on the freeway. Instead, he took Cahuenga to Franklin and turned east. Ferras was looking out the passenger side window, but quickly noticed the detour.
"What's going on? I thought we were going downtown."
"We're going to the donut hole on Vermont."
"We just stayed an hour ago."
Bosch checked his watch. It was almost 8, and he hoped he wasn't too late.
"I'm not going for the donuts."
Ferras cursed and shook his head.
"You're going to talk to the man?" he asked. "Are you kidding?"
"Unless I missed him already.
If you're worried about it, you can stay in the car."
"You're jumping about 5 links in the chain, you know. Lieutenant Gandil is going to have our asses for this."
"He'll have my ass."
"You stay in the car. It will be like you weren't even there."
"Except what one partner does, the other always gets equal blame for. You know that. That's how it works. That's why they call them partners, Harry."
"Look, I'll take care of it. There's no time to go through proper channels. The chief should know what is what, and I'm going to tell him. He'll probably end up thanking us for the heads up."
"Yeah, well, Lieutenant Gandil won't be thanking us."
"Then I'll deal with him, too."
The partners drove the rest of the way in silence. The Los Angeles Police Department was one of the most insular bureaucracies in the world. It had survived for more than a century by rarely looking outward for ideas, answers, or leaders. A few years earlier, when the city council decided that after years of scandal and community upset, it required leadership from outside the department, it was only the second time in the LAPD's long history that the position of chief of police was not filled by promoting from within the ranks. Subsequently, the outsider who was brought in to run the show was viewed with tremendous curiosity, not to mention skepticism. His movements and habits were documented, and the data was all dumped into an informal police pipeline that connected the department's 10,000 officers like the blood vessels in a closed fist. The intelligence was passed around in roll calls and locker rooms, text messages to and from patrol car computers, emails and phone calls at cop bars and backyard barbecues. It meant street officers in South LA
knew what Hollywood premiere the new chief had attended the night before. Vice officers in the valley knew where he took his dress uniforms to be pressed, and the gang detail in Venice knew what supermarket his wife liked to shop at. It also meant that Detective Harry Bosch and his partner, Ignacio Ferras, knew what donut shop the chief stopped at for coffee every morning on his way into Parker Center. At 8 a.m., Bosch pulled into the parking lot of the donut hole, but saw no sign of the chief's unmarked car. The business was an aptly named establishment. Bosch killed the engine and looked over at his partner. "You staying?" Ferras was looking straight ahead through the windshield. He nodded without looking at Bosch. "Suit yourself," Bosch said. "Listen, Harry, no offense, but this isn't working. You don't want a partner. You want a gopher and somebody who doesn't question anything you do. I think I'm going to talk to the lieutenant about hooking me up with someone else." Bosch looked at him and composed his thoughts. "Ignacio, it's our first case together. Don't you think you should give it some time? That's all Gandil's going to tell you. He's going to tell you that you don't want to start out in RHD with a reputation as a guy who cuts and runs on his partner." "I'm not cutting and running. It's just not working right."
"Ignacio, you're making a mistake."
"No, I think it would be best for both of us."
Bosch stared at him for a long moment before turning to the door. "Like I said, suit yourself."
Bosch got out and headed toward the donut shop. He was disappointed in Ferris's reaction and decisions, but he knew he should cut him some slack. The guy had a kid on the way and needed to play it safe. Bosch was not one to ever play it safe, and it had lost him more than a partner in the past. He would take another shot at changing the young man's mind once the case settled down. Inside the shop, Bosch waited in line behind two people and then ordered a black coffee from the Asian man behind the counter.
"No donut?"
"No, just coffee."
"Cappuccino?"
"No. Black coffee." Disappointed with the meager sale, the man turned to a brewer on the back wall and filled a cup. When he turned back around, Bosch had his badge out. "Has the chief been in yet?" The man hesitated. He had no idea about the intelligence pipeline and was unsure about responding. He knew he could lose a high-profile customer if he spoke out of turn.
"It's all right," Bosch said. "I'm supposed to meet him here. I'm late."
Bosch tried to smile as though he was in trouble. It didn't come out right, and he stopped.
"He not here yet,"
the counterman said.
Relieved he hadn't missed him, Bosch paid for the coffee and put the change in the tip jar. He went to an empty table in the corner. It was mostly a takeout operation at this time of morning, people grabbing fuel on their way into work. For 10 minutes, Bosch watched a cross-section of the city's culture step up to the counter, all united by the addiction to caffeine and sugar. Finally, he saw the black town car pull in. The chief was riding in the front passenger seat. Both he and the driver got out. Both scanned their surroundings and headed toward the donut shop. Bosch knew the driver was an officer and served as a bodyguard as well. There was no line at the counter when they came in.
"Hi, you, chief,"
the counterman said.
"Good morning, Mr. Ming," the chief responded. "I'll have the usual."
Bosch stood up and approached. The bodyguard, who was standing behind the chief, turned and squared himself in Bosch's direction. Bosch stopped.
"Chief, can I buy you a cup of coffee?" Bosch asked.
The chief turned and did a double take when he recognized Bosch and realized he wasn't a citizen wanting to make nice. For a moment, Bosch saw a frown move across the man's face. He was still dealing with some of the fallout from the Echo Park case. But then it quickly disappeared into impassivity.
"Detective Bosch," he said. "You're not here to give me bad news, are you?"
"More like a heads up, sir." The chief turned away to accept a cup of coffee and a small bag from Ming.
"Have a seat," he said. "I have about 5 minutes and I'll pay for my own coffee."
Bosch went back to the same table as the chief paid for his coffee and donuts. He sat down and waited while the chief took his purchase to another counter and put cream and sweetener into his coffee. Bosch believed that the chief had been good for the department. He had made a few missteps politically and some questionable choices in command staff assignments, but had largely been responsible for raising the morale of the rank and file. That was no easy task. The chief had inherited a department operating under a federal consent decree, negotiated in the wake of the FBI's Rampart corruption probe and myriad other scandals. All aspects of operation and performance were subject to review and compliance assessment by federal monitors. The result was that the department was not only answering to the feds, but was awash in federal paperwork. Already an undersized department, it was hard sometimes to see where any police work was getting done. But under the new chief, the rank and file had somehow pulled together to get the job done. Crime stats were even down, which to Bosch meant there was a good possibility that actual crime was down as well. He viewed crime statistics with suspicion. But all of that aside, Bosch liked the chief for one overarching reason. 2 years earlier, he had given Bosch his job back. Bosch had retired and gone private. It didn't take him long to realize it was a mistake, and when he did, the new chief welcomed him back. It made Bosch loyal, and that was one reason he was forcing the meeting at the donut shop. The chief sat down across from him. "You're lucky, detective. Most days I would have been here and gone an hour ago. But I worked late last night hitting crime watch meetings in three parts of the city." Rather than open his donut bag and reach in, the chief tore it down the middle so he could spread it and eat his two donuts off it. He had a powdered sugar and a chocolate glazed. "Here's the most dangerous killer in the city," he said, as he raised the chocolate glazed donut and took a bite. Bosch nodded. "You're probably right." Bosch smiled uneasily and tried an icebreaker. His old partner, Kiz Ryder, had just come back to work after recovering from gunshot wounds. She transferred out of robbery homicide to the chief's office, where she had worked once before. "How's my old partner doing, chief?"
"Kiz? Kiz is good. She does fine work for me, and I think she's in the right spot."
Bosch nodded again. He did that a lot.
"Are you in the right spot, detective?"
Bosch looked at the chief and thought it was a loaded question. The chief might already be questioning his jumping the chain of command. Before he could work up an answer, the chief asked another question. "Are you here about the Mulholland Overlook case?" Bosch nodded. He assumed that the word had gone up the pipe from Lieutenant Gandel and that the chief had been briefed in some detail about the case.
"I work out for an hour every morning just so I can eat this stuff," the chief said. "The overnights are facts to me, and I read them on the recumbent bike. I know you caught the Overlook case, and it's got federal interest. Captain Hadley also called me this morning. He said there is a terrorism angle."
Bosch was surprised to learn that Captain Dunbadley and the OHS were already in the picture.
"What is Captain Hadley doing?" he asked.
"He hasn't called me."
"The usual.
Checking our own intelligence, trying to open lines with the feds?"
Bosch nodded.
"So, what can you tell me, detective? Why did you come here?" Bosch gave him a fuller rundown on the case, accenting the federal involvement and what was looking like an effort to shut the LAPD out of its own investigation. Bosch acknowledged that the missing cesium was a priority and true cause for the feds to throw their weight around. But he said the case was a homicide, and that cut the LAPD in. He went over the evidence he had collected and laid out some of the theories he had been considering. The chief had consumed both donuts by the time Bosch was finished. He wiped his mouth with a napkin and then checked his watch before responding. They were well past the 5 minutes he had initially offered.
"What aren't you telling me?" he asked.
Bosch shrugged.
"Not much. I just had a little dust-up with an agent at the victim's house, but I don't think anything will come of it. Why isn't your partner in here? Why is he waiting in the car?"
Bosch understood. The chief had seen Ferris when he scanned the lot upon his arrival.
"We're having a little bit of a disagreement on how to proceed. He's a good kid, but he wants to roll over for the feds a little too easy. And, of course, we don't do that in the LAPD.
Not in my time, chief." Did your partner think it was appropriate to ignore the department's chain of command by coming directly to me with this? Bosch dropped his eyes to the table. The chief's voice had taken on a stern tone. As a matter of fact, he wasn't happy about it, Chief. Bosch said, It wasn't his idea, it was mine. I just didn't think there was enough time to... Doesn't matter what you thought. It's what you did. So if I were you, I would keep this meeting to yourself, and I will as well. Don't ever do it this way again, Detective. Are we clear on that? Yes, clear. The chief glanced toward the glass display case where the donuts were lined up on trays. And by the way, how did you know that I would be here? He asked. Bosch shrugged. I don't remember, I just sort of knew. He then realized that the chief might be thinking that Bosch's source was his old partner. It wasn't Kiz, if that's what you mean, Chief, he said quickly. It's just something that gets known, you know? Word gets around the department. The police chief nodded. It's too bad, he said. I liked this place. Convenient, good donuts, and Mr. Ming takes care of me. What a shame. Bosch realized that the chief would now have to change his routine. It would not serve him well if it was known where he could be found and when. Sorry, sir, Bosch said, but if I might make a recommendation. There's a place in the farmer's market called Bob's Coffee and Donuts. It's a bit out of the way for you, but the coffee and donuts would be worth it. The chief nodded thoughtfully. I'll keep it in mind. Now, what is it you want from me, Detective Bosch? Bosch nodded. Time to get down to the business at hand. I need to take the case where it goes, and to do that, I need access to Alicia Kent and her husband's partner, a guy named Kelber. The feds have them both, and I think my window of access closed about 5 hours ago. After a pause, Bosch got to the point of the whole unscheduled meeting. That's why I'm here, Chief. I need access. I figure you can get it for me. The chief nodded. Besides my position in the department, I sit on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. I can make some calls, raise some hell, and probably open the window. As I said before, we have Captain Hadley's unit on this already, and perhaps he can open up the channels of communication. We have been kept out of the loop on these things in the past. I can raise the flag, put in a call to the director. Bosch nodded. It sounded like the chief was going to go to bat for him. You know what reflux is, Detective? Reflux? It's a condition where all the bile backs up into your throat. It burns, Detective. Oh. What I'm telling you is that if I make these moves and I get that window open for you, I don't want any reflux. You understand me? I understand. The chief wiped his mouth again and put the napkin down on his torn bag. He then crumpled it all into a ball, careful not to spill any powdered sugar on his black suit. I'll make the calls, but it's going to be tough. You don't see the political angle here, do you, Bosch? Bosch looked at him. Sir, the bigger picture, Detective. You see this as a homicide investigation. It is actually much more than that. You have to understand that it serves the federal government extremely well with this thing on the overlook being part of a terrorism plot. A bona fide domestic threat would go a long way toward deflecting public attention and easing the pressure in other areas. The war's gone to shit, the election was a disaster. You got the Middle East, the price of a gallon of gasoline, and a lame duck president's approval ratings. The list goes on and on. And there would be an opportunity here for redemption, a chance to make up for past mistakes, a chance to shift public attention and opinion. Bosch nodded. Are you saying that they might try to keep this thing going, maybe even exaggerate the threat? I'm not saying anything, Detective. I am just trying to broaden your perspective. A case like this, you have to be aware of the political landscape. You can't be running around like a bull in a china shop, which in the past has been your specialty. Bosch nodded.
Not only that, you have local politics to consider, the chief continued. You have a man on the city council who lies in wait for me. The chief was talking about Irvin Irving, a longtime commander in the department whom the chief had forced out. He'd run for a city council seat and won. He was now the department's and the chief's harshest critic. Irving? Bosch said. He's just one vote on the council. He knows a lot of secrets. It's allowed him to start building a political base. He sent me a message after the election. It was just two words. Expect me. Don't turn this into something he can use, detective. The chief stood up, ready to go. Think about it and be careful, he said. Remember, no reflux, no blowback. Yes, sir. The chief turned and nodded to his driver. The man went to the door and held it open for his charge. Chapter 13. Bosch didn't speak until they were out of the parking lot. He decided that by this time of day, the Hollywood freeway would be overrun by the morning commute, and surface streets would be better. He believed that sunset was the fastest way downtown. Ferras only made it two blocks before asking what had happened in the donut shop. Don't worry, Ignacio. We both still have our jobs. Then what happened? He said you were right. I shouldn't have jumped command, but he said he would make some calls and try to open things up with the feds. Then I guess we'll see. Yeah, we'll see. They drove in silence for a while until Bosch brought up his partner's plan to ask for a new assignment. You still going to talk to the lieutenant? Ferras paused before answering. He was uncomfortable with the question. I don't know, Harry. I still think it would be best for both of us. Maybe you work best with female partners. Bosch almost laughed. Ferras didn't know Kiz Ryder, his last partner. She never went along to get along with Harry. Like Ferras, she objected every time Bosch went alpha dog on her. He was about to set Ferras straight when his cell phone started buzzing, and he pulled it out of his pocket. It was Lieutenant Gandil.
Harry, where are you?
His voice was louder than usual and more urgent. He was excited about something, and Bosch wondered if he had already heard about the donut hole meeting. Had the chief betrayed him? I'm on Sunset. We're heading in.
Did you pass Silver Lake yet?
Not yet.
Good. Head up to Silver Lake. Go to the rec center at the bottom of the reservoir.
What's going on, Lieutenant?
The Kent car's been located. Hadley and his people are already out there setting up the CP. They've requested the investigators on scene.
Hadley? Why is he there? Why is there a command post?
Hadley's office got the tip and checked it out before deciding to clue us in. The car is parked in front of a house belonging to a person of interest. They want you on the scene.
Person of interest? What's that mean?
The house is the residence of a person the OHS has an interest in, some sort of suspected terrorist sympathizer. I don't have all the details. Just get there, Harry.
All right, we're on the way.
Call me, and let me know what's happening. If you need me out there, just say the word.
Of course, Gandil didn't really want to leave the office and go to the scene. That would set him back on his daily management duties and paperwork. Bosch closed the phone and tried to pick up speed, but the traffic was too thick for him to get anywhere. He filled Ferras in on what little he knew from the phone call.
What about the FBI? Ferras asked.
What about them?
Do they know?
I didn't ask.
What about the meeting at 10?
I guess we'll worry about that at 10. In 10 minutes, they finally got to Silver Lake Boulevard, and Bosch turned north. This part of the city took its name from the Silver Lake Reservoir, which sat in the middle of the largely middle-class neighborhood of bungalows and post-World War II homes with views of the man-made lake. As they approached the recreation center, Bosch saw two shiny black SUVs that he recognized as the signature vehicles of the OHS. Apparently, he thought,
There was never much trouble getting funding for a unit that supposedly hunted terrorists. There were two patrol cars and a city sanitation truck as well. Bosch parked behind one of the patrol cars, and he and Ferris got out. There was a group of 10 men in black fatigues, also distinctive to the OHS, gathered around the fold-down rear gate of one of the SUVs. Bosch approached them, and Ferris trailed a couple of steps behind. Their presence was immediately noticed, and the crowd parted, and there was Captain Don Hadley sitting on the gate. Bosch had never met him, but had seen him often enough on television. He was a large, red-faced man with sandy hair. He was about 40 years old and looked like he had been in the gym working out for half of them. His ruddy complexion gave him the look of someone who had overexerted himself or was holding his breath.
"Bosch?" Hadley asked. "Ferris?"
"I'm Bosch. This is Ferris."
"Fellas, good to have you here. I think we're going to tie your case up for you in a bow in short order here. We're just waiting on one of my guys to bring the warrant, and then we go in."
He stood up and signaled to one of his men. Hadley had a definite air of confidence about him.
"Perez, check on that warrant, will you? I'm tired of waiting. Then check the OP and see what's happening up there."
He then turned back to Bosch and Ferris.
"Walk with me, men."
Hadley headed away from the group, and Bosch and Ferris followed. He led them to the back of the sanitation truck so he could talk to them away from the cluster of other men. The captain adopted a command pose, putting his foot up on the back end of the truck and resting his elbow on his knee. Bosch noticed that he carried his sidearm in a leg holster that was strapped around his thick right thigh, like an Old West gunslinger, except he was carrying a semi-automatic. He was chewing gum and not trying to hide it. Bosch had heard many stories about Hadley. He now had the feeling that he was about to become part of one.
"I wanted you men to be here for this," Hadley said.
"What exactly is this, Captain?" Bosch replied. Hadley clapped his hands together before speaking.
"We've located your Chrysler 300 approximately 2.5 blocks from here on a street bordering the reservoir. The plate matches the Bolo, and I eyeballed the vehicle myself. It's the car we've been looking for."
Bosch nodded. That part was good, he thought. "What's the rest?"
"The vehicle is parked in front of a home owned by a man named Ramin Samir," Hadley continued. "He's a guy we've been keeping our eye on for a few years now, a real person of interest to us, you might say."
The name was familiar to Bosch, but he couldn't place it at first.
"Why is he of interest, Captain?" he asked. "Mr. Samir is a known supporter of religious organizations that want to hurt Americans and damage our interests. What's worse than that is that he teaches our young people to hate their own country."
The last part jogged Bosch's memory, and he put things together. He could not recall which Middle Eastern country he was from, but Bosch remembered that Ramin Samir was a former visiting professor of international politics at USC, who had gained widespread notice for espousing anti-American sentiment in the classroom and in the media. He was making media ripples before the 9/11 domestic terrorist attacks. Afterward, the ripples became a wave. He openly postulated that the attacks were warranted because of U.S. intrusion and aggression all around the globe. He was able to parlay the attention this brought him into a position as the media go-to guy for the ever-ready anti-American quote or soundbite. He denigrated U.S. policies toward Israel, objected to the military action in Afghanistan, and called the war in Iraq nothing more than an oil grab. Samir's role as agent provocateur was good for a few years of guest shots on the cable news debate programs, where everybody tends to yell at one another. He was a perfect foil for both the right and the left, and always willing to get up at 4 a.m. to make the Sunday morning programs in the East. Meantime, he used his soapbox and celebrity status to help start and fund a number of organizations on and off campus that were quickly accused by conservative interest groups and in newspaper investigations of being connected, at least tangentially, to terrorist organizations and anti-American jihads. Some even suggested that there were links to the Grand Master of all terror, Osama bin Laden. But while Samir was often investigated, he was never charged with any crime. He was, however, fired by USC on a technicality. He had not stated that his opinions were his own and not those of the school when he wrote an op-ed piece for the Los Angeles Times that suggested the Iraq War was an American planned genocide of Muslims. Samir's 15 minutes ran their course. He was eventually discounted in the media as a narcissistic provocateur who made outlandish statements in order to draw attention to himself rather than to thoughtfully comment on the issues of the day. After all, he had even named one of his organizations the YMCA, for Young Muslim Cause in America. Just so the long-established youth organization with the same internationally recognized initials would file an attention-getting lawsuit. Samir's star waned, and he dropped from public sight. Bosch could not remember the last time he had seen him on the box or in the paper. But all the rhetoric aside, the fact that Samir was never charged with a crime during a period when the climate in the United States was hot with fear of the unknown, and the desire for vengeance always indicated to Bosch that there was nothing there. If there had been fire behind the smoke, then Ramin Samir would be in a prison cell or behind a fence at Guantanamo Bay. But here he was, living in Silver Lake, and Bosch was skeptical of Captain Hadley's claims.
"I remember this guy," he said. "He was just a talker, Captain. There was never any solid link between Samir and..."
Hadley held up a finger like a teacher demanding silence.
"Never a solid link established," he corrected. "But that doesn't mean anything. This guy raises money for the Palestinian Jihad and other Muslim causes."
"The Palestinian Jihad?" Bosch asked. "What is that? And what Muslim causes? Are you saying Muslim causes can't be legit?"
"Look, all I'm saying is that this is a bad dude, and he's got a car that was used in a murder and cesium heist sitting right in front of his house."
"Cesium," Ferris said. "It was cesium that was stolen."
Not used to being corrected, Hadley narrowed his eyes and stared at Ferris for a moment before speaking.
"Whatever. It's not going to make much difference what you call it if he dumps it into the reservoir across the street, or is in that house putting it in a bomb while we're sitting here waiting on a warrant."
"The FBI didn't say anything about it being a waterborne threat," Bosch said. Hadley shook his head.
"Doesn't matter. Bottom line is that it's a threat. I'm sure the FBI said that. Well, the Bureau can talk about it. We're going to do something about it."
Bosch stepped back, trying to draw some fresh air into the discussion. This was moving too quickly.
"So you're going to go in?" he asked.
Hadley was working his jaw in quick, powerful bites of the gum. He seemed not to notice the strong odor of garbage emanating from the back of the truck.
"You're damn right we're going to go in," he said, "just as soon as that warrant gets here."
"You got a judge to sign a warrant that's based on a stolen car being parked in front of the house?" Bosch asked. Hadley signaled to one of his men.
"Bring the bags, Perez," he called. Then to Bosch he said, "No, that's not all we got. Today's trash day, detective. I sent the garbage truck up the street, and a couple of my men emptied the two cans that were in front of Samir's house. Perfectly legal, as you know.
And looky at what we got."
Perez hustled over with the plastic evidence bags and handed them to Hadley.
"Captain, I checked the OP," Perez said. "Still quiet up there." "Thank you, Perez."
Hadley took the bags and turned back to Bosch and Ferris. Perez went back to the SUV.
Our observation post is a guy in a tree, Hadley said with a smile. He'll let us know if anybody makes a move up there before we're ready.
He handed Bosch the bags. Two of them contained black woolen ski masks. The third contained a slip of paper with a hand-drawn map on it. Bosch looked closely at it. It was a series of crisscrossing lines with two of them marked as Arrowhead and Mulholland. Once he registered these, he could tell the map was a fairly accurate rendering of the neighborhood where Stanley Kent had lived and died. Bosch handed the bags back and shook his head. Captain, I think you should hold up. Hadley looked shocked by the suggestion.
Hold up? We're not holding up. If this guy and his pals contaminate the reservoir with that poison, do you think the people of this city are going to accept that we held up to make sure we dotted every I and crossed every T? We're not holding up.
He underlined his resolve by taking the gum out of his mouth and throwing it into the back of the sanitation truck. He took his foot off the bumper and started heading back to his crew, but then made a sudden U-turn and came back directly to Bosch.
As far as I'm concerned, we've got the leader of a terrorist cell operating out of that house, and we're going to go in and shut it down. What's your problem with that, Detective Bosch?
It's too easy. That's my problem. It's not about us dotting every I, because that's what the killers already did. This was a carefully planned crime, Captain. They wouldn't have just left the car in front of the house or put this stuff in the trash cans. Think about it.
Bosch held there and watched Hadley work it over for a few moments. He then shook his head. Maybe the car wasn't left there, he said. Maybe they still plan to use it as part of their delivery. There are a lot of variables, Bosch. Things we don't know. We're still going in. We laid it all out to the judge, and he said we have probable cause. That's good enough for me. We've got a no-knock warrant coming, and we're going to use it.
Bosch refused to give up. Where did the tip come from, Captain? How did you find the car?
Hadley's jaw started working, but then he remembered he had tossed his gum.
One of my sources, he said. We've been building an intelligence network in this city for almost 4 years. Today it's paying off.
Are you telling me you know who the source is, or did it come in anonymously?
Hadley waved his hands in a dismissive manner.
Doesn't matter, he said. The info was good. That's the car up there. There's no doubt about that.
He pointed in the direction of the reservoir. Bosch knew by Hadley sidestepping that the tip was anonymous, the hallmark of a setup.
Captain, I urge you to stand down, he said. There is something not right about this. It's too simple, and this wasn't a simple plan. It's some sort of misdirection, and we need to figure out...
We're not standing down, Detective. Lives could hang in the balance.
Bosch shook his head. He wasn't going to get through to Hadley. The man believed he was poised at the edge of some sort of victory that would redeem every mistake he had ever made.
Where's the FBI? Bosch asked.
Shouldn't they be...
We don't need the FBI, Hadley said, getting in Bosch's face again. We have the training, the equipment, and the skills. What's more, we have the balls, and for once we're going to take care of what's in our own backyard ourselves.
He gestured to the ground as if the place where he stood was the last battlefield between the Bureau and the LAPD.
What about the chief? Bosch tried. Does he know? I was just...
Bosch stopped, remembering the chief's admonishment about keeping their meeting at the donut hole to themselves.
You were just what? Hadley asked.
I just want to know if he knows and approves.
The chief has given me full authority to run my unit. Do you call the chief every time you go out and make an arrest?
He turned and marched imperiously back to his men, leaving Bosch and Ferris to watch him go.
Uh-oh, Ferris said.
Yeah, Bosch said. Bosch stepped away from the back of the foul-smelling sanitation truck and pulled out his phone. He scrolled through his directory to Rachel Walling's name. He had just pressed the call button when Hadley was there in his face again. Bosch hadn't heard him coming.
Detective, who are you calling?
Bosch didn't hesitate.
My lieutenant. He told me to update him after we got here.
No cellular or radio transmissions. They could be monitoring.
They who?
Give me the phone.
Captain?
Give me the phone or I will have it taken from you. We're not going to compromise this operation.
Bosch closed the phone without ending the call. If he was lucky, Walling would answer the call and be listening. She might be able to put it together and get the warning. The Bureau might even be able to triangulate the cell transmission and get to Silver Lake before things went completely wrong. He handed the phone to Hadley, who then turned to Ferris.
Your phone, Detective.
Sir, my wife is 8 months pregnant, and I need your phone, Detective. You are either with us or against us.
Hadley held his hand out, and Ferris reluctantly took his phone from his belt and gave it to him. Hadley marched over to one of the SUVs, opened the passenger door, and put the two phones into the glove box. He slammed the compartment shut with authority and looked back at Bosch and Ferris as if challenging them to try to retrieve their phones. The captain's attention was then distracted when a third black SUV pulled into the lot. The driver gave the captain a thumbs up. Hadley then pointed a finger into the air and started a twirling motion.
"All right, everybody," he called out. "We have the warrant, and you know the plan. Perez, call air support and get us the eye in the sky. The rest of you warriors, mount up. We're going in."
Bosch watched with growing dread as the members of the OHS chambered rounds in their weapons and put on helmets with face shields. Two of the men began putting on spacesuits, as they had been designated the radiation containment team.
"This is crazy," Ferris said in a whisper.
"Charlie don't surf," Bosch replied.
"What?"
"Nothing. Before your time." Chapter 14. The Slick banked over a 30-acre rubber plantation and put down in the LZ with the usual spine-compressing final drop. Harry Carey Bosch, Bunk Simmons, Ted Furness, and Gabe Finley rolled out into the mud, and Captain Gillette was there waiting for them, holding his helmet on top of his head so he wouldn't lose it in the rotor wash. The chopper labored as it pulled its skids out of the mud. It was the first dry day after 6 days of rain and took off, following the line of an irrigation canal, back in the direction of 3 Corps HQ.
"Walk with me, men," Gillette said.
Bosch and Simmons had been in country long enough to have nicknames, but Furness and Finley were fresh and strictly OJT, on-the-job training. And Bosch knew they were scared shitless. This was going to be their first drop, and nothing they taught you back at tunnel school in San Diego could prepare you for the sights, sounds, and smells of the real thing. The captain led them to a card table set up under the command tent and outlined his plan. The tunnel system under Ben Catt was extensive and needed to be taken out as part of a first-wave attempt to take control of the village above. Already, the casualties from sappers and sneak attacks inside the camp perimeter were mounting. The captain explained that he was getting his ass eaten out on a daily basis by 3 Corps command. He didn't mention anything about being bothered by the dead and wounded he was losing. They were replaceable, but his favor with the colonel at 3 Corps was not. The plan was a simple crimp operation. The captain unrolled a map drawn with the aid of villagers who had been in the tunnels. He pointed to 4 separate spider holes and said the 4 tunnel rats would go down simultaneously and force the VC in the tunnels toward a 5th hole, where the warriors of Tropic Lightning would be on top, waiting to massacre them. Along the way, Bosch and his fellow rats would set charges, and the operation would finish with the implosion of the entire tunnel system. The plan was simple enough until they got down there in the darkness, and the labyrinth didn't match the map they had studied on the card table under the tent. 4 went down, but only 1 came back up alive. Tropic Lightning got 0 kills that day, and that was the day that Bosch knew the war was lost, for him, at least. That was when he knew that men of rank often fought battles with enemies that were inside. Bosch and Ferris rode in the back seat of Captain Hadley's SUV. Perez drove, and Hadley rode shotgun, wearing a radio headset so he could command the operation. The vehicle's radio speaker was on loud and set to the operation's back channel frequency, one that would not be found listed in any public directories. They were 3rd in line in the entourage of black SUVs. Half a block from the target house, Perez braked to let the other two vehicles move in as planned. Bosch leaned forward between the front seats so he could see better through the windshield. Each of the other SUVs had four men riding on runners on either side. The vehicles picked up speed and then turned sharply toward the Samir house. One went down the driveway of the small craftsman-style bungalow toward the rear yard, while the other jumped the curb and crossed the front lawn. One of the OHS men lost his grip when the heavy vehicle impacted the curb, and he went tumbling across the lawn. The others leaped from the runners and moved toward the front door. Bosch assumed the same thing was happening at the back door. He didn't agree with the plan, but admired its precision. There was a loud popping sound when the front door was breached with an explosive device, and almost immediately there was another from the rear.
All right, move up, Hadley commanded Perez.
As they drove up, the radio came alive with reports from inside the house.
We're inside! We're in the back!
Front room clear!
The voice was cut off by the sound of automatic gunfire.
Shots fired!
We've got...
Shots fired!